Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to the update on Oyster European Equity Strategy. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. I must advise that today's conference is being recorded today, December the 13th, 2017. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Nancy Ducray. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome to this European Equities Strategy Review. So today with us are Claire Shaw and Michael Clement. Mike is the head of European Equities team at Fifth Asset Management and the fund manager of the co-fund Oyster European Opportunities and its more concentrated higher alpha version, Oyster European Selection and Oyster Continental European Selection. Also part of the European Equities team, Claire is the fund manager of Oyster European Mid and Small Cap Fund. Since they joined us in 2014, the funds they are managing are all outperforming their respective markets while exhibiting a positive upside-downside capture ratio. Following the tumultuous 2016 on the political front, 2017 was closing out to be a rather less eventful year. In Europe, the overall market is up more than 10% so far and more than 16% for the small caps. With a volatility at historically low level, technology names, financial services and industrial goods were leading the way, while telecom and oil and gas companies lagged. So now I hand over to Claire and Mike to explain how the funds perform in this market environment and also to give us their input on the opportunities they initiated for 2018.
Hello, thank you Natalie, and hello everyone and welcome to the call. Thank you very much for taking the time this morning. So as Natalie said, what Claire and I will do is we'll take you through the 2017 performance in terms of what worked, what didn't work, and then we'll finish up just talking a bit about how our funds are positioned, where we think the alpha is going to be generated in the coming years. And I'll probably take about 15 minutes or so to do that, to keep this quite short. And after that, of course, we'll be able to open up, and any questions that you have, we'll be very happy to try and answer. So I did a call like this, I remember back in January 2017, and I was talking about the 2016 year, and I called it a year to remember, which if you remember 2016, it seems quite a long time ago now, but if you remember 2016, it was really characterized by surprises, uncertainty. We had obviously the Trump election, the Brexit vote, and we had quite a lot of sector rotations. And I would say that 2017 compared to 2016 is completely different, characterized more by a momentum-driven market, helped by obviously some good earnings growth at the index level and some very benign economic data. And above all, though, I think this year has been characterized by what has been, for us at least, an amazing lack of volatility, which shows up in a number of different ways. So, for example, if you look at the VIX, which is the index which is, of course, measuring volatility of the highly liquid US stock market, it hit all-time lows during the year. And the same is true in other asset classes if you look at the volatility. Bond market, interest rate markets, and other asset classes are all showing an amazing lack of volatility. And that, combined with ultra-low interest rates, means that we've seen as a result momentum-driven strategies and strategies which are going short volatility, either implicitly or explicitly, doing very well. Essentially, if the whole investment world continues to hunt for yield. Of course, these days you can't have a conversation about investment without talking about Bitcoin, but I'm sure you have your own views on the amazing rise in the share in the price of the Bitcoin. But personally, I'm not convinced that there'd be that much interest in Bitcoin if we had an environment where there was alternative assets at attractive prices. And I think it's really just a phenomenon of what is going on across the whole investing world. Against this backdrop, I would say that for our strategies, we've had a tougher year. We'll show you the data in a second. But this lack of volatility that I talked about shows up in markets in European equities in the sense that most sectors and most countries are actually in a very benign, stable state, which makes our sort of contrarian stock-picking approach, which obviously thrives on volatility and short-term dislocations in share prices, a bit more difficult. Having said that, you know, Claire and I are both long-term investors. We have a five-year investment horizon. And if you look across our portfolios, both of us are happy with the way we're currently positioned, and indeed we see some very good upside across the portfolios over the coming years. So let me talk a bit about performance in general, then we'll get into the detail for both my fund and for the small mid-cap fund run by Claire. Hopefully you've got the slides in front of you. Slide 3 summarizes some of Natalie's comments about both short-term and long-term performance data. What we can see in 2017, this is data until the end of November, but December so far we're roughly flat against the market, so what you see here is likely to be close to the figures that we actually finished the year with. And of course you can see for 2017, the short-term data, we're ahead of the index in European selection, the all-cap concentrated portfolio, the higher alpha version of what we do. We're ahead of the benchmark by about 200 basis points. And European opportunities is roughly flat versus the benchmark as of today. And continental European selection and European small mid-cap are behind the index for this year. And we'll give you some data about what's driven those performances in a second. As Natalie mentioned, the three-year numbers and the longer numbers since inception, since Claire and I have been at running these funds at peak, are still very positive, where our funds are anywhere between 1% to 6% ahead of the benchmark over three years annualized, and the same true of the slightly longer since inception numbers. So the long-term performance are very strong, especially in our more concentrated higher alpha funds. So what I'll do is I'll walk through slide 4 onwards, just talking a bit about the performance and drivers, what's worked both at the stock level and the overall portfolio level, and then we'll talk a bit about some of the themes and positions that are in our portfolio today. So slides 4, 5 and 6, and indeed slide 7, is actually quite a lot of detail about the top contributors both at the stock level and the sector level. And I'll let you go through that detail at your leisure, but we'll highlight a few of the winners and losers this year. But before I get into the detail of stocks, if you just step back and look at the sort of environment we've been in, as I said, it's been a momentum-driven type market, but also within that, if I look at the various indices, there's been sectors which have performed very well, which typically, in our approach, we typically don't have very high weightings to. So, for example, if you look at the Stock 600 index, the technology sector is up 24% this year, utilities up 14%, the material sectors up about 14% as well, and of course the banks have been very strong. If you take the small cap index, the Stock 200, telecoms is up again 34%, utilities up an amazing 45%, the banks, the smaller cap banks have had a very good year and up 28%. And again, these are sectors which in our small and mid-cap fund players typically doesn't find many good ideas in, and so our funds are typically underweight these sectors. So we've been operating in an environment with a sort of headwind against us, which has cost us a little bit of performance. That's probably the first thing to say. Having said that, you know, if you come onto the portfolio I run and you look at the themes we've had running through the portfolios, a lot of our themes have worked very well. So if you take, for example, the European Opportunities Fund and the European Selection Fund, we've been very good at stock picking within the financial sector. As you know, we typically don't own banks, and that's been a headwind to our portfolio this year. But we typically have been invested in a range of other financial stocks, including stock-specific ideas like Burford Capital, stock-specific ideas like Core Estate, a real estate play, asset managers, and diversified financials. And as a group, they've worked extremely well this year. You know, if you take European Opportunities, for example, it's added about 1.5% of overperformance. In European Selection, obviously the more concentrated all-cap portfolio, it's added even more. It's been the key positive this year, with about 400 basis points of relative performance coming from the financial stocks we've owned. So that, you know, that's been a very good thing to see, because I think sometimes clients, remember that we don't like banks, but you know, sometimes don't remember that we're actually pretty good at finding other ideas in the financial world. So that's been a good positive this year. Our emerging market stocks, where we've been playing through asset managers such as Ashmore, Aberdeen, some of our luxury goods names such as LVMH have worked very well as a group, adding about 70 to 100 basis points. And then offset against that, we've had sort of mixed performance in both construction and energy. Energy in particular has been a very interesting year, where we've seen quite wild gyrations in the oil price, depending on what was going on with OPEC. And generally speaking, the larger cap names have underperformed the overall market. We don't own those, but we do have within our portfolio some mid-cap oil exposure, and so we've been kind of neutral. So if you step back and just look at the themes, what's worked for us for this year has been financials and emerging markets. What hasn't worked for us is banks and utilities in particular. Coming on to some of the stock-specific issues and the or drivers in the funds, you can see, if you look on slide 4, and you take European Selection Fund, we've had some very strong performances from companies such as Burford, Core Estate, and XL Media. And we've got some commentary, and we can go into detail about exactly what's worked here. But these are essentially stocks which are not really on most other investors' radar screen. If you take a company like XL Media, which is, in my opinion, the best way to play the growth in online gambling around the world, you know, that stock's up 70% this year, and yet it's still only trading on a 10% free cash yield. It's on 11 times PE. And it's really a stock which has been off most people's radar screen and has been quietly going about its business, generating very high levels of organic growth. And as a result, the performance has come through in the share price as people are starting to discover it. And actually what you'll see in all our portfolios is we're pretty good at finding stocks which are just overlooked by the market. And I think these top three stocks here, Burford, Core Estate, and XL Media, are good examples of that. Core Estate Capital, for example, one of the big contributors in the European Selection Fund, with the stock up 118% this year after good performance again in 2016, was really driven by the fact that they made a series of good mergers, which grew its assets under management. It's an investment manager in the real estate market in Germany. It grew its assets from €3 billion of assets under management to €22 billion of assets, which is an amazing growth. Through a series of acquisitions where there's very large synergies come out and they bought them at extremely good prices. And at €3 billion, this really was a company which flew under the radar screen of most investors, but now it manages €22 billion. This is actually a pretty major investment manager in the European market, and as a result, we're seeing more attention from short-term investors, we're seeing more coverage by the sell side, and that's part of the reason why we've seen this re-rating up. It's gone from being an unknown stock to actually a known stock, and you know, through our long-term stock picking approach, we're often able to find these stocks quite early. Other quite positives this year have been what I would call classic contrarian traits. If you take European opportunities, the data on slide 5, you'll see stocks in the top three such as LVMH, Louis Vuitton. I'm sure I don't need to introduce Louis Vuitton to anyone on the call. It's a very well-known company, extremely well-managed company with some amazing brands. You know, this stock, if you went back 2 or even 3 years ago, was completely out in favor with investors simply because as the Chinese economy slowed and we saw a knock-on impact into spending of luxury goods by Chinese consumers, you know, the market took a very strange view, I thought, on luxury goods stocks, which basically said that luxury goods demand is dead. You know, at that point, we saw figures from analysts talking about luxury goods demand growing only at 1 or 2% a year, whereas historically it had grown at a far, far higher rate. And essentially there was this debate about whether luxury goods spending was in cyclical decline or structural decline. We did a lot of work 2-3 years ago, decided actually that this was a cyclical slump, nothing more. And across our portfolio we added a number of luxury goods names, including LVMH. And if you come forward to 2017, all that's happened this year is simply that the consumer, the Chinese consumers come back to the market, spending money again, they're traveling around the world, going on holiday, buying luxury goods, and as a result we've seen very strong demand in a number of luxury goods names, including LVMH, and as a result the market rewarded it with a higher rating. So for example, LVMH is up 37%, it's growing organically at 14% a year, and this is essentially a classic sentiment-driven contrarian trade, which of course we are pretty good at making money in. The same is true of Ashmore. Again, it is obviously an emerging market debt manager. Again, 2 years ago, emerging markets debt were completely out of favour. Ashmore, as an asset manager, was suffering from flows out of its products. And all that's happened in 2017 is that flows have ended, and we're now seeing strong inflows into its various products. And of course, an asset manager like that is quite leveraged to flows in terms of markets are higher, so they earn more money, but also they can leverage their fixed cost base. And as a result, Ashmore shares have performed extremely well this year. So that's been the sort of positives of in terms of my portfolio. You know, we've had these two groups of stocks, either completely unknown stocks, which have now come into the radar screen of short-term investors, or classic contrarian trades such as LVMH and Ashmore, which have generated good alpha this year. And this is, I think, if you invest in our funds, you know, this is what I think one of the benefits you get from investing with us. On the flip side, and I'll talk about the big negative of the year, which you can see on slide 4, and indeed in the small cap fund as the biggest negative, which is this stock called Flow Traders. Now, I talked at the very start about the lack of volatility in the market, and really this is hurt a company like Flow Traders. Flow Traders is the leading ETF market maker in Europe. It has about 20% market share. And what you get with Flow Traders when you invest in it, you get two things. You get the long-term structural growth in ETF investing, which, as I'm sure we all know, is increasing by the day. More and more assets are going passive, driven by the very low fees. So you get the long-term structural trend of growth in ETFs if you invest in Flow Traders. However, in the short term, Flow Traders is a very strong way, a very good way to play volatility, in that what happens when the markets are volatile and when people are buying and selling and changing their asset allocation rapidly, often intraday, is that volume of ETF traders goes up, and Flow Traders' revenue is directly correlated to the amount of volume that is traded on the ETFs. So revenue is volume times the spread that they charge. Of course, at the moment, we've got the opposite situation of no volatility. There is no trading in ETFs. You can see the data clearly in the market. ETF volumes this year compared to last year are down about 18%. And as a result, Flow Traders' profitability is under pressure. We were too early into the stock. Frankly, we bought this stock in 2016 as a way to play volatility normalizing. And all that's happened since is that volatility has gone the other way, and it's reached, as I said, unprecedented, really low levels. We've never seen the market as benign as we have now. So we lost money in 2017 because of this. You can see on, for example, slide 4, this has cost the European Selection Fund about 2.5% relative. However, you know, what we do in these circumstances is what you would expect us to do, which is to go back and re-evaluate the investment case, stress test again the investment case on the downside. And our conclusion on Flow Traders is actually we're very well protected here. You know, our modelling shows that if the current levels of low volatility persist, we're going to get a very good return of about 8-9% a year. And if it normalises back up to the levels we see typically, we're going to make a double-digit per annum return in this stock. And as a result, we've been buying and adding to our position in Flow Traders all year. And there's actually, in my opinion, the highest conviction, the best idea we have across our portfolios right now. On the back of that, I'm going to talk about this a bit more when I come and talk about the positioning and the themes in the portfolio. We've actually been searching for other ways to access volatility play, other market infrastructure stocks, and we've added a number of new interesting ideas to the portfolios this year, essentially going long volatility when the whole world seems to be going short volatility. And as a long-term contrarian, that's a position I feel very comfortable with. So that's maybe just some highlights from the three funds I am responsible for: European Selection, European Opportunities, and the Continental European Portfolio. What I'll do is I'll hand it over to Claire to give you some of the highlights for small and mid-cap portfolio. This is data on slide 7. And then I'll finish up by just talking about some of the positions we have in our funds and where we see 2018 going. So Claire, I'll hand it over to you and you can talk through small and mid-cap.
Perfect. Thanks, Mike, and many thanks to everybody for joining today. As Mike mentioned at the beginning of the call, 2017 has been a tough year for the small and mid-cap fund, and as you've touched upon briefly, I mean, there's been a number of headwinds, I guess I would say, that have worked against us. And the first thing I'd point out is you can see just how strong the European small and mid-cap benchmark has been. It's up near 16%. Year to date, you know, that's about 6% more than the broader European index. And as many of you know, My son has a typically a low beta, so you know, really struggled a little bit to keep up in this really rising market. But probably what's more interesting and what's cost us is really the strength of sectors which I've typically and actually have always been underweight, and those are utilities, which is up 44% year to date, telecoms up 34%, and technology up 32%. And if you think about the types of businesses I typically buy, very high quality, high return, pricing power, net cash balance sheet, you know, those sectors typically have not really been a happy hunting ground for us. And as I say, being underweight those sectors when they've risen so strongly has really cost us on a relative performance basis. However, saying that, there has been some really good stock selection in the portfolio year to date, and notably speaking would be Burford Capital, which is the UK litigation finance player. These shares are up over 100% year to date. And for those of you that know Burford, you know that the share price has been strong over the last 3 years. And just to give you a sense, it's up nearly 600% since we actually bought the stock 2.5 years ago. So it's been very strong in 2017. There's been a number of factors. They've sold some tranches in a very large deal called the Peterson deal. And they raised about $100 million of that, which obviously has been very positive for from a risk management perspective from Burford. They have a big case in Argentina at the moment, and as I say, there's a positive outcome on that case as well. Burford's entitlement is roughly about $140 million there. And I don't know if you recall, they bought the number two player in the industry earlier on in the year, Gerson Keller, and really the early performance of the fund's business there has been posting some very, very good numbers. So there has been lots of positives for Burford. As I say, I mean, this company's up a phenomenal amount since we bought it. Both of Mike and I have felt it has been prudent to take some profits along the way, so we have trimmed the position and taken advantage of that. But we really think there's still a lot to go in this business. Litigation finance, you know, is still a relatively young asset class, but the potential to generate very, very high returns, and probably what's most interesting is that it's a very uncorrelated asset class. So it's really interesting from a diversification benefit that it brings the portfolio. So we think the investment case is very strong, even though it continues to perform well. In terms of other positive contributors, for the small and mid-cap funds, one of the centurion themes that we played last year was really an improvement in the French macro situation. Recall last year, France was, you know, not the most favoured country to be positioned in. But as you saw with Macron being elected, their recovery in French stocks has been very good. And we had Ellis, which is the number one player in linen management. You know, they collect tablecloths and napkins from restaurants, wash them and iron them and deliver them back to restaurants and hotels, etc. So very much a play on domestic consumption. And it's performed incredibly well year to date, really due to that pickup in France. They also made a large acquisition, a UK company, Berenson. And what that really has offered Ellis is they have become the pan-European leader, and that's got big synergy benefits and long-term strategic benefits to the company as well. And Television Frontier 1, which isn't mentioned here, but again is a play on the French advertising market, which has been very strong year to date. So the contrarian theme that we played last year of French macro recovery has done incredibly well, and it's added about 150 basis points to relative performance to those two names. And the other key call that we made was playing the Italian financial space. And Mike and I have probably mentioned to many of you last year that it was a theme that we, you know, we were quite interested in December of last year with the referendum. So we bought some Italian asset managers, but in the middle of the year there was a very interesting IPO that came to the market called DuBank. Put is the leader in NPL, the largest independent servicer of non-performing loans in Italy, which is actually the largest market in Europe, about 390 billion of non-performing loans, and they have about 60% market share. It's a very, very good business, very scalable platform, and that's performed incredibly strong since the IPO. They recently announced a deal to service about 8 billion of the bad loans out of Monte dei Paschi as well. So Dubank is a business that we continue to think has got very, very good long-term potential, really playing this NPL market in Italy. On the downside, what's affected us, Mike's already talked about flow traders, so I won't repeat what he said, but you can see in the data there on slide 7, it's attracted about 300 basis points from relative performance, so that really does account for a large part of that underperformance versus the benchmark. But as I say, we remain very confident in the long-term business model due to the pickup in volatility. So even though the performance has been poor, I remain very, very happy with the position and the long-term opportunity for flow traders. What's probably the one key difference versus the all-cash strategies I've had in the portfolio that has been a negative detractor has been Dialog Semiconductor, which has had a tough month. What's happened with Dialog is that a few weeks ago there was a rumour that Apple, which is Dialog's largest customer, potentially plans to insource the power management chips that Dialog provides for them. As it stands, you know, we're doing a lot of work on this. We're trying to speak to various experts in the industry to get a better understanding of what's going on. But as you can imagine, Apple are very secretive in terms of what they're working on and what their plans are. Dialog have said there's no change to the normal relationship, but nevertheless, we're continuing to try to work out what is happening there and what the risks are. And as I say, the rumours has caused the stock to drop quite substantially over the years. So that has attracted some performance. And then finally, it's just really on Riverstone Energy, which is nothing really stock specific. But if you look at the European small mid-cap index, energy really has been the worst performing sector in that space. And as Mike alluded to earlier, you know, it's been volatile year in terms of news flow. And Riverstone has just been weak along with sentiment in that sector. So nothing stock specific there. It's just, as I say, in line with the broader energy sector. So I guess in conclusion, you know, I remain very confident in the long-term positioning of the names in the portfolio. Things like CoTraders, I think, is a really exciting idea. And hopefully we will see it. We'll see it turn around with a pickup as volatility hopefully normalises next year. And with that, I'll just pass you back to Mike, who will probably talk about more about our positioning and what we see for the year ahead.
Thanks, Claire. So on slide 8, and this is where I'll finish. We're just talking a bit about current positioning and some of the more recent moves in our portfolios. Of course, we're pure one-off spot pickers. You know, most of our portfolios are consisting of just individually interesting ideas, which don't really meet any sort of theme or sort of idea, but just interesting. So, for example, Claire's bought a very interesting diamond company called Lucara recently. She also bought a company called Iron Beam, which is a very exciting new way of treating cancer called proton therapy. In my portfolio, I bought Pandora, the well-known jewellery company, which is a classic sentiment-driven short-term out-of-favour stock, which we think is going to make a very good return over the next 5 years. Or a company like Technicolor, a way to play growth in both Hollywood blockbuster digital effects, but also growth in connected homes in terms of set-top boxes and the Internet of Things. These are all individual ideas which sort of don't really fit into any sort of theme, but of course a stock pickers are able to take advantage of them. Having said that, when I look across our portfolios, there are some themes and running through them which helps in terms of thinking about what could drive performance over the next 2, 3, 4 years. And there's really three major themes I think I want to highlight at the moment, and we've touched on some of these already, but I'll just flag them again. Claire talked about the Italian non-performing loans crisis. As you know, in 2016, one of the major things we did was we looked into the Italian banks and the problems that they were having, and we've ended up buying and taking advantage of that crisis by buying a couple of or two or three different stocks. We bought some asset managers, one of which we've recently sold, Anima, because it's played out. That was a play on the recovery of Monte Paschi without having to buy actually the bank itself. But also we still have, as Claire mentioned, DuBank, this NPL servicing company with 60% market share. That started to perform well, but we still think there's a lot more to go for if that Italian crisis plays out. And also in my portfolio, I own Eurocastle, which actually physically takes its own balance sheet and invests actually in the non-performing loans themselves. So, for example, recently they bought a chunk of NPLs from UniCredit, who were trying to get them off their balance sheet, and they bought them at an extremely attractive price. If I remember correctly, it's about 14 euro cents in the euro, a very, very low price. And as a result, as those loans are collected in, using DuBank actually, Eurocastle was able to earn a very good return for investors like ourselves. So we have still the Italian NPL crisis theme running through all our portfolios, and we're very confident that's going to play out over the medium term and get a good performance. Then the middle bucket is really a newer theme where we've been looking for ways to play the recovery in the housing market in Spain. As you know, the housing market in Spain went through a bubble pre-2008 as there was a lot of overbuilding in many parts of the country. And of course that all came crashing to a halt in 2008-2009. A lot of that of that property was repossessed by the banks. As the original owners couldn't make the payments on their loans. What's happened since then is actually very interesting. The housing market's been in very weak for the last 3, 4, 5 years, but it's just started recovering. You look at data in terms of house prices in Barcelona or Madrid, or indeed the actual volumes bought and sold, it's starting to pick up. And so we were looking for ways to play this, and we bought into our portfolio two interesting companies, and I'll just maybe highlight the top one there, which is called Aedas Homes. And Aedas is very interesting. What's happened is a private equity fund in America went to Spain in 2012, 2013, and 2014, and they bought from the banks all the best land. They went and cherry-picked the best land across the whole of Spain in the big regional centres of Spain, and they bought that land from the banks at very, very attractive prices. Often the banks had no idea what they actually owned in their portfolios, and Aedas was able to go and say, we want to buy this piece of land, and they were the only buyer. They bought it at an extremely good price. As you know, house building is a very simple business. You buy some land, you build some flats or houses on top of it, and then you sell it at the market price. And what really determines the ability to earn high returns is simply the price that you pay for the land. You know, the cost of actual building flats is pretty much the same for everyone. So what determines the winners and losers in the industry is really how well you're able to buy the land. And Aedas and Neynor Homes have both got extremely attractive portfolios, the best portfolios of land in Spain, and now they're going to, over the next 5 years, build homes on those properties, on that land, and realise the returns which are locked into their land banks. And we think this is a very interesting way to play both a high return business, but a business also that's playing a recovery in something that until quite recently has been highly out of favour. So we have this Spanish housing theme running through the portfolios. And the last one, which I'll flag and probably most exciting, I think, is that, which I talked about earlier, is this idea that normalisation of volatility is going to happen at some point. You know, volatility, by its very nature, never stays the same for very long. And at the current levels, it's only a matter of time, I think, until the world normalizes and we get more volatility. And we've been positioning our portfolios to take advantage of that. I've talked about Flow Traders, you know, this ETF market maker, but we've also owned in our portfolios other ways to play volatility picking up just in different asset classes. So, for example, we own GPI Cap, a UK-listed company. It's the world's leading interdealer broker, making markets on hard-to-trade instruments in the energy space, in the fixed income space. They're traded over the telephone. They are world leaders and will benefit from the pickup in volatility. We own companies such as Deutsche Börse, obviously the German stock exchange, which through its it has about 40% of its profits coming from index derivatives. Similar sort of idea to Flow Traders, that when volatility picks up, people change their asset allocation, rapidly to get the exposure they want. In the case of Deutsche Börse, they do it by buying and selling index derivatives, and Deutsche Börse are the market leader in that space. We also have IG Group, which is a retail spread betting company. Again, when markets are volatile, retail investors rate go long and short various instruments and take advantage of that volatility, and so volumes traded go up and IG Group benefits as a result. So these are all ways to essentially play normalization of volatility, which we think as a standalone idea is probably the best contrarian idea we can find in the European market right now, but also has an additional benefit to our portfolio, which is if we see any market weakness because, I don't know, steepening yield curves or interest or tighter monetary conditions or some sort of market shock. I don't know what it could be, but you know, if there's a market shock, then these are the kinds of businesses which actually will perform very well and will, I think, shield and protect our portfolio, give some good, you know, in relative terms, some good protection to our portfolio compared to an ETF or a passive investor through these positions that we have. And when I look at it, it's quite interesting. I think this demonstrates actually quite well our approach. As you know, we're long-term and we're contrarian. We try and take advantage of that in our portfolios. And actually, we're often drawn to companies that do the same. So if you take, you know, the Spanish stock, you know, the reason we like them is because the original owners of that went into the Spanish market when it was highly out of favor and bought what was then a very out of favor land at very good prices. We like that. You know, we can take advantage of it. If you take the Italian NPL crisis, you know, companies like Eurocastle, which is obviously an investor in non-performing loans, were able to buy these loans at extremely cheap prices in a contrarian fashion when no one else really wanted them, and now reaping the benefits of it. So in terms of what we do in our own portfolios, often we like companies that do the same in their own businesses, whether we're talking about buying land or buying distressed loans. We often are attracted to companies that do think the same as us, and hence why they end up in our portfolios. So I'll stop there. Hopefully that gave you a sort of feeling or a flavour of what's driven our performance in 2017, but also where we think performance is going to come from in 2018 and beyond. And with that, I'll stop. I'll hand it back over to you, Natalie, and open up for any questions that you have.
Thank you. Operator, can you please remind us how to ask questions?
Of course, if you'd like to ask a question today, please press star and one on your telephone keypad. That's star and one to ask a question today.
Okay, we have a question here.
Yes, Michael, by looking at your portfolios, we noticed that they have a quite low downside capture. Can you develop a bit on how you managed to keep it that low and protect your portfolios during the long term?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question, and I think it starts with our style of investing naturally leads to portfolios that have lower levels of downside capture than the market. So if you think about what we typically look for in our portfolios, we're generally looking for three things, all of which I think contribute to this characteristic. I mean, firstly, we're looking for good companies, generally. You know, companies that tend to do okay in most markets, good markets and bad markets, but especially in bad markets, high-quality companies that have strong competitive advantages in its in the market and in the sectors that they operate in, tend to do okay. You know, in fact, they tend to take market share away from weaker competitors, and that is part of the reason why they tend to react better than the overall market in tough times. Then on top of that, we're obviously looking for companies that have strong balance sheets, and often we have very net cash balance sheets, especially in the small and mid-cap part of the market. If you look at Claire's portfolio, you'll see that she has a lot of companies which have net cash balance sheets. And again, that protects us. You know, when there's a market drawdown or when there's distress in the market, companies that have strong balance sheets tend to react in a better way than companies which are highly operationally and financially leveraged naturally. And so by avoiding those financially leveraged companies, our portfolio is protected on the downside. And then the third thing I think is, you know, the valuations we pay is low. You know, we're trying to buy these companies when they're already out of favor with other investors. And now, sometimes we're a little early, but generally speaking, what happens is these companies are already out of favor. So when, and they're already pricing in whatever it is, short-term fears that are going on in the market. And when companies are, you buy companies that, good companies are that sort of distressed price or low price, then actually you tend to already miss the downside, and so you don't capture it, if the market's weak. So I think it starts with the fact that we, our style of investing tends to lead to companies that has this characteristic. And then I think Claire mentioned when she talked about small cap, I think where we struggle actually is the other side, when we get a very momentum driven market where the small cap market's up 16% this year, driven by tech and, sectors which we typically don't find very interesting. We are doing well if we capture 100% of that upside, if we keep up with that strong market. But really, on the downside where the markets are weak, that's where we tend to, in the short term, our performance tends to be better than the market because of these kind of stocks. And actually, that's where we actually can add some value because we can then replenish our portfolios with some very interesting ideas, also for distressed prices. So that's our strong environment, so to speak. I don't know if that really answers your question, but that's how I would characterize that characteristic of low downside capture that we typically see.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. Do we have other questions?
We do, yes. We have a question from the line of David Thornton. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning, Mike. Just wondered if there was any update on the flow traders and the Dutch regulator and these sort of bank-style capital rules.
Yeah, morning, David. Thanks for the question. So just in case other people on the call are not familiar with what David's asking. So flow traders has recently had some two bits of negative news, which was part of the reason why the shares have been weak, where the Dutch regulator, which regulates flow traders, said two things. They're looking at increasing the capital requirements for trading firms such as flow traders, and they're also putting a cap, or proposing to put a cap, on the amount of bonus you can pay your staff starting in about 3 years' time. So they're the two negative things. So David, to your question, there's no update at all from the regulatory point of view. There's no update from the regulator. On the day actually of the announcement of that regulator, both Claire and Prad, my financials analyst, were actually in flow traders' offices in Holland just on a site visit by chance. So we had a chance to discuss it with them, and we've continued to do work on this subject since then. So there's no official update from the company, but our analysis is as follows, which is if you look at flow traders' balance sheet, it's already very strong. It already has, pre any increased potential capital requirements, has 2.5 times more capital than the regulators currently say it's needing. So it's very unlikely that even if the regulator puts up the capital requirements, that flow traders' balance sheet gets into to any trouble. So the question on the capital requirements comes down to the interpretation of how the regulator views netting of positions. So flow traders is market neutral at all times, but of course it has positions on both long and short, which nets to basically being zero against the market. And the amount of capital depends on how the regulator views the allowability of the netting. Now, Prad has spent about a week going through the minutiae of banking regulation. If you can tell, we've had a very exciting time. And according to us, as far as we can see, the regulator should allow the netting, but it's really, we're waiting for a ruling. We don't think that it's actually an issue, even if they do have to call for more capital. The second issue is to do with how much you can pay your staff in terms of bonus. And typically, one of the things we like about flow traders is it pays its staff a low basic wage, and then it pays a relatively large bonus. And that fits perfectly with its business model because its revenues are quite variable, going up and down in terms of ETF volumes. And so having this sort of high degree of variability in the comp base is actually something which we think is actually very appropriate for its business. Now, we're less certain on how this is going to play out. I mean, firstly, the cap that they're proposing is extremely low and not in line with what you see in other markets. So they're proposing a 30% maximum bonus, which I think is very, very low. So we'd be surprised if it goes through the regulator anyway. But nevertheless, we're talking to the company, we're doing our own analysis about what the impact could be. I mean, worst case is essentially that the fixed cost for flow traders goes up, as they have to basically increase base salaries, and that will basically mean that we get more operational leverage into the business than we have at the moment. And we're modelling through that, and we're quite relaxed about that given where we are at the moment. In fact, it's probably, given that we think there's more upside in terms of volume traders than downside at the moment, it would probably be a positive if it gets brought in. in the short term, but nevertheless, it's something which we are working through in our own minds. I don't know if that gives you sort of any comfort, but that's where we are at the moment on those two topics.
Okay, that's great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Do we have another question?
There are no further questions at this time.
Okay, so thank you, Claire. Thank you, Mike. And thank you, all of you, for joining this call. And thank you for your interest in the strategy. If you have other questions, please feel free to contact us. And in the meantime, I wish you all already a Merry Christmas.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may now all disconnect.